Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
I mean, I don't know how sinister and conspiratorial you want to get.
As much as we can. Friends, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Monday, July 13th, and you are welcome. You know what? We'll start like that. You are welcome for inviting Steve Patterson back to the show. Steve and I have been collaborating since 2016. Last time I talked to Steve before this conversation was his fantastic two-part presentation in our Ideas into Action Summit. You'll hear me say this in my conversation, but Steve is one of my go-to guys. You know, when something happens in the world, I ask, what does Steve Patterson think? That was actually how I picked the presenters for the Ideas into Action Summit. And I know Steve has been a little bit less active. He's been involved in other things. We're going to talk about that on the show today as well. He's been a little less active with his YouTube and his podcast. So I wanted to hear his thoughts on 2020 so far. And the way this conversation is going to be set up for your listening pleasures is I split it into two parts because I think some of the really valuable stuff comes towards the end of what turned out to be an almost two-hour conversation. And I know you got a lot of things to listen to, and I know 2 hours is a big ask all in one shot. So today, part one, we get Steve's take on the problem. And this Wednesday, we're going to focus on some great critical thinking strategies that Steve uses to gain a better understanding in his pursuits of new knowledge. For the handful of deeply unfortunate people who right now are saying, who is Steve Patterson? In a nutshell, I would say Steve is a philosopher and a polymath who chose an independent online avenue over a career in academia. He's somebody who certainly would have had, I don't know if promising is the right word, like promising career in academia. What are you being promised, right? A classroom full of public school graduates who are just so courageous and critical that day in and day out, they are putting you to the test, challenging you to keep you sharp, saying, I don't care if my grade usually depends on agreeing with people like you. I'm here to exchange ideas. So year after year, you're just growing wiser, but more curious about the world with a growing humility about how much you still don't know. And all of this wonderful personal growth culminates with a performance on Tucker Carlson's show where you totally don't make a fool out of yourself. None of that is promised. None of that is promised. So to say he had a promising career in higher education, that might not be the right phrasing, but he is certainly somebody who could have chosen that path. But one of the things that I admire most about Steve, he chose to cut his own path. It's certainly something we've been promoting here for a long time, and it is a great pleasure and honor to be able to work with him. So that's who Steve is. I highly recommend you check out Steve's work at steve-patterson.com. His podcast is called Patterson in Pursuit. He has a wonderful book called Square One, The Foundations of Knowledge. Square One is a kind of challenge to the postmodern thought that is so popular today. But what can I say? I missed Steve, so it makes perfect sense that we would reunite for a two-hour conversation. Also, because earlier in this monologue, I mentioned the Ideas into Action Summit, I want to let you all know that every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, that is 3 days a week, if you followed that, at 9:30 a.m. Eastern, I have been hosting group discussions for participants in the Ideas into Action Summit. And on Wednesday and Friday, we merge with Richard Grove's autonomy students. Some of that stuff is getting put up on Patreon and in the AV Club for supporting listeners, but I post links for these Zoom meetings in the Discord for Ideas into Action. So if you attended the summit back in October, or you have purchased the digital downloadable version since then, which you can still do at ssponiversity.com/ideas into action, use the coupon code PURSUIT, as in Patterson in Pursuit. That's, again, the name of Steve's podcast. Coupon code PURSUIT. If you do that, you will save 30%, and I will send Steve some of your money. So if you were an all-access pass holder for Ideas into Action, or you are one of Rich's autonomy students, and for some reason you haven't been able to access this or find out about this, send me an email, and I'll make sure you can get in Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. The goal is to every Monday cover something from the summit as far as like principles or strategies or lessons or challenges. Wednesday focuses more on autonomy topics, which is very much about self-reliance. And then on Friday, it's more of a free-for-all, freestyle kind of conversation. People can talk about current events or anything that might have rubbed them the wrong way from one of the conversations earlier in the week. So it's been great to interact with new people, to get feedback, to share ideas, to strategize. I mentioned the schedule because I like to have some idea of what's going to happen, but certainly not a script, you know? Like last Monday, in just an informal meet and greet, somebody mentioned that they have that bias training at work, and they were told they had to read the book White Fragility. So I just explode for like 45 minutes about that. And this week, just right before I'm recording this, finished a very measured and I thought constructive and connected conversation about romantic relationships and attachment theory. But that Monday theme is, what are we learning and how can we help each other? So I love it so far. Some things coming up in our near future. More Steve Patterson on Wednesday. I was on Bob Murphy's show last Friday. That went very well. I have Isaac Morehouse this Wednesday. I'll be dropping a little note in the School Sucks group, taking topic suggestions for that conversation. I have more guests and activities to announce soon, but we're going to leave it there for today. I wanted to actually share with you a video. This was weird, and I should be over it at this point, because this really isn't that weird anymore. This is the world in which we live, right? Where our devices, our streaming services, our social media platforms, goddamn toasters and washing machines are all spying on us. So if I have a conversation into my computer about certain subject matter and keep repeating certain keywords, I mean, these things are going to show me things, you know? Pretty sure it's happening if I'm just thinking about things now, and I'd really like to know how that works. But we won't get into that until David Icke is here. That'll be next Tuesday. It's not true. But what was the point? All right, so we have this conversation, and then the number one suggested video to me on YouTube is this Peter Hitchens, who turns out to be the brother of Christopher Hitchens. I didn't know there were more Hitchenses, but there's this Peter, and he's not bad. And the title of the video was "The Authoritarian Left Never Rests." And since I said that the first part of this conversation with Steve is introducing a kind of problem, I think we have some solutions for in part two. I'd like you to hear from this Peter Hitchens character, lay a little bit of that out before we get started. So I'm going to play that clip and then we'll get right into my show with Steve. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back on Wednesday.
At some point, I mean, I'm an ex-Bolshevik, and this does two things for me. One, it means that I have a lot to be guilty about. Secondly, it gives me insights into the politics and nature of the modern left, which most people don't have. One of the things that I did when I was still a revolutionary socialist was try and prevent people from exercising freedom of speech and thought. It came naturally to me. It came naturally to me because I believed that what I thought and desired was so good that anybody who disagreed with me must, by their nature, be evil and be deserving of being silenced. And this is the problem. The general left-wing belief, which is held by the elites of most Western countries now, is also a belief in their own virtue. And if you believe very strongly in your own virtue, and your virtue is based, it's almost a caricature of justification by faith alone. You are a good person because you hold certain opinions. Therefore, if you hold other opinions, you're a bad person. And I think that makes dialogue pretty much impossible. If you think your opponent is bad, not just wrong, but bad, why should you listen to a word he says? Well, they don't.
Well, why is it then that we can't learn the lessons of history? It's not as if it's so very... You lived in Soviet Russia for a long time. You saw the outcomes of that sort of elitist view.
The left have learned the lessons of history to this extent. They understand that the Bolshevik attempt failed, that the Soviet experiment was a disaster. That hasn't cured them of wanting to create paradise on Earth. They've just thought, how should we do it another way? Which is how we come to Antonio Gramsci, one of the first and most intelligent communists to understand that the Soviet experiment had failed as long ago as the 1920s. He realized that the civilized working classes of Western Europe were never going to swallow this sort of thing, that there had to be a huge cultural revolution before they ever would. And his ideas took root, particularly in the big Southern European communist parties, his own in Italy, in the final years of the Soviet Empire, and began to spread out beyond the communist parties themselves into the left in general, the ideas of cultural, moral and social revolution, not by violent overthrow, not through dictatorship of the proletariat, not even through seizure or sequestration of industries and banks, but through the capture by the long march to the institutions of the television studio and the university and the newspaper office and the publishing house and the school, so that after 30 or 40 years of that, you would control pretty much the public mind and you would be able to get pretty much what you wanted. And it's clever. And you have to concede to these people some admiration for their endless determination, their deep belief in what they want, and their subtle and in many cases very clever organization to achieve it. It's been a very, very well exercised revolution, and they have learned from history. The one thing they haven't learned, which I wish they would learn, is that they're wrong. But they have learned how to be wrong better, and that is why we have to fear them so much.
So two questions immediately arise for me. Given that the great bulk of people are surprisingly sensible when it comes to not being misled by intelligentsia...
I would completely disagree with that. I think the great bulk of people are incredibly easily misled. I find it over and over again. People I like, people with who might write to me one week and say, I really liked what you wrote. The next week will be sprouting some drivel about the Russian menace or whatever fashionable nonsense happens to have been fed to them by the media they trust. It's extraordinary how gullible people are.
I find that a very challenging thought as somebody from a country where we pride ourselves on our pragmatism and our ability to see through bulldust. We think we do. Now, you've been...
Well, of course, one of the great things about thinking that you see through it is that people who think that and who pride themselves on it are often the most fantastically gullible people of all.
Well, it's an interesting...
It takes some nerve not to run with the crowd. I mean, I'm not given particularly to self-praise. I know my faults better than most people. And thanks to an awful lot of YouTube, I also know what I look like. Vanity is difficult in my position. But one thing I will say is that I have... Maybe it's an instinct I've had since childhood, probably a gift not given to me, not a thing that I can claim any credit for, but I will not run with crowds. But most people will, and they do, and they're happier that way.
Well, there's a point Jordan Peterson makes to his classes in Canada. You know, he points out to people that statistically speaking, they might say that they would not have joined the Hitler Youth, but statistically speaking, they would have.
Yeah.
We would have. I would have, probably. But it does still concern me, particularly in my own country.
You look at the word people who didn't. I mean,
very few.
I confessed, I think, I read this book of Not Me, mainly about his father saying, I'm not having this. But it was extremely hard not to do, and most people did it. And just as most people wouldn't have been in the French Resistance if they'd been in France in 1942, they just wouldn't have done it.
Anyway, that was part one, as a sort of plea on behalf of people in the street. They need to be more conscious of what's happening. But the second part that I wanted to drill into there is, You have very, very bright people, at least we think we have, we taxpayers in universities. Why are there not more academics? You know, if wisdom is the ability to understand consequences and courage is the ability to point them out, why are there not more academics pushing back against some of these ideas which have proven not just disastrous in practice, but as you point out, in theory as well? They don't work in theory. Communism doesn't work in theory either.
Hang on a minute. We'll move on to communism in a minute, if I may, but you said that one of the qualities you're looking for is an ability to understand consequences. You mustn't assume that academics are so selfless that the ultimate consequences of society, perhaps after they're dead, are more important to them than the immediate consequences for their careers. But if I were an academic, I think I would know, indeed, or if I were in broadcasting, I think I would know pretty quickly that if I didn't fit in with the general conformist view of these matters, then I couldn't expect to get tenure or to rise in my profession. And these things are ultimately possibly more important to people than the total coherence or indeed the ultimate consequences of the points of view they espouse. Anyway, anybody can fool himself into believing that his own position is going to lead to paradise. People do that all the time.
I am somewhere in the city. I am climbing up a fire escape. I am somewhere in the city. I am climbing up a fire escape. I have gotta save my baby from the mess this world has made. I arrive through a window, I leave through a hole in the wall. I arrive through a window, I leave through a hole in the wall. I scramble down the stairwell with my baby, cradle and all. Helicopter, helicopter, let your long rope down. Let us sway into the sunset. I have done all I can do in this town.
Can you believe it's been 4 years since we started working together?
My goodness, really, that long?
It was February 2016, and the last time I had you on the show, we were talking about Kenneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Oh, man, that discussion seems so academic at this point.
Yeah, I think there were rustles of you and I thinking like, oh, things are looking kind of bad in the United States, at least from a rational perspective. It sure doesn't look like we're going down the path of rational public discourse. And boy, that has certainly been heightened in the past few years.
Absolutely.
The past 6 months, really.
Yeah. But it was, you're right, because it was 2017. It was post-election, and we were kind of putting the pieces together of, not that it was super hard to do at the time, but looking at everything that was happening post-election, and then again around the inauguration. Yeah, it looked gloomy, and last whatever that's been, 3 years, has bared out what predictions we had. So because you're a listener favorite, I just wanted to give you a chance to bring us up to speed on what's new with you, what you're doing, where you are, all that.
Yeah, so I'm currently in Arizona. We've been here about a year and a half. My wife and I have been dealing with some long-term health issues that hopefully we're coming to the end of. We're hoping in the next 6 months or so. And Arizona is beautiful. It's got very high quality air. The dryness is good for our health. So we've been here. We love it. I'd only been to Arizona once. And when I was working for the Foundation for Economic Education, we were putting on a seminar. And we flew into Phoenix. And I don't even remember where the seminar was. But I had this horrible impression of Arizona. I was like, this horrible desert. It's way too hot. Why in the world would anybody live here? It was, I think, July when we flew in. Mm. And so that was my impression of Arizona. But we live up in Prescott, which is northern Arizona, which is up in the hills. It's called the High Desert.
Like near Sedona?
Yeah, it's near Sedona. It's like an hour or so outside of Sedona. And it's so beautiful. It's unbelievably pretty here. The trees are amazing. There's tons of sunshine. It's temperate. So yeah, we're loving it in Arizona.
My quote when I pulled into that area for the first time in my life is, I think I said, this is just like New Hampshire, but also Arizona. You know,
yeah. It's a lot nicer weather, though, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sedona was great. We actually, I won't go into the long health story, but we actually ended up going back and forth across the country over a period of a few months in a bad string of events. But we wound up camping. For our first experience in Arizona was in a tent because we were reacting to various things. So we were camping for about a month in a state park just outside of Sedona. And not very glamorous to like live in a tent for a little bit, but man, it sure was pretty.
Yeah.
And and now I used to be like, I'm not a camping person, not an outdoorsy person, but just that month in a tent, I'm like, oh man, I totally get it. I'm definitely going to be an outdoors guy.
What kind of critters do you have to worry about there? I remember getting to Arizona for the first time and just petrified of the critters. In fact, I went hiking. The person I was hiking with, I was like, look, there's going to be rattlesnakes. We were down in the Phoenix area. I said, there are going to be rattlesnakes. And I think she said, I've never seen a rattlesnake in my life. Sure enough, 15 minutes into the hike, right in the middle of the trail.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. So we haven't had to deal with any critters until recently. I suppose that's not true. When we were camping, there were aggressive skunks that got used to the people leaving food around the campsites. So like in the middle, for the first week we were there, in the middle of the night, there were these scratches at like 2 o'clock in the morning around the tent. That was a little disconcerting. And then you'd go out and you'd have to like, you walk to the little restroom area and you'd see skunks skittering away. It's like, I don't really want to be sprayed. But that is minor compared to just the last few months in this new place that we're staying. I have found a couple of scorpions inside the house in the morning. Oh. And I guess scorpions are not poisonous in general, except there's like one actually dangerous type of scorpion, which is called the Arizona bark scorpion. It's like yay long. It's really small.
Yeah.
And it happens to be one that I found a couple of times in the house because it likes houses. It likes to be inside, and it's one of the only scorpion breeds that can climb walls. So I found it like on the walls and on the floor and stuff. So if you don't mind the occasional scorpion in your house, it's not been too bad. But honestly, scorpions compared to when I was living in Atlanta, there's a bunch of roaches, and there was a lot. Every morning you'd go out and the roaches would skitter away and there's nothing you could do about them. I probably would take the scorpions, to be honest.
Mm. So Arizona is great. All things considered. Yeah. And do you want to talk a little bit about just what you've been doing to keep busy?
Yeah. Well, mainly it's been health. I don't know. A couple of years ago, it was clear that we were on a downward trajectory, and I had a bad habit of ignoring health problems and pretending like they would go away, and they didn't. They just got worse when you ignore them. So we've been mainly focused on a lot of recuperation. There's been a lot of sleep, a lot of it's a long story. Maybe I'll come on the show and talk about it after we're fixed. My wife, Julia, has been working on a really compelling theory of nutrition and health in general. And we're eventually going to tell people about it, but we want to make sure we're fixed first. Hmm. And we want to make sure that our, you know, the theory is as high quality as we can make it before we tell people. But, outside of that, I've been doing a lot of my own philosophical investigations, and right now I'm actually working on another Bitcoin book. It's my first ghostwriting project. There's a entrepreneur in the space who he and I are very aligned on a lot of issues, and the time is right for a book explaining what happened with the Bitcoin split. We don't have to go into any detail, but there was a big split that happened in 2017 in the world of Bitcoin, and generally only one perspective, one side of the story has been told. And like anything else, that side of the story is wrong. So my job is to kind of tell the other side of the story. So that's what I'm doing right now, at least professionally.
Right. And that was quite controversial. We talked about it a little bit on my show. I had Roger Ver on the Bitcoin Cash side of the controversy.
Yeah.
I know you recently talked to him on one of Isaac Morehouse's podcasts. You've been vocal on that. And we you're right. We don't have to get too into this, but you've been vocal on that for a long time.
Since about 2014, actually.
Yeah.
Or maybe even 2013. So I wrote What's the Big Deal About Bitcoin. It was either the end of 2013 or 2014. I don't actually remember at this point. But there was... The debate was already the seeds of the the split were already there in the Bitcoin world. And I was on the big blocker side since before there was a position called small blockerism, mm-hmm. because everybody in the industry, Satoshi included, understood that the Bitcoin was supposed to scale a certain way, and then everything kind of changed. So, but yeah, I've been public about it, and I was going to write a book myself, the sequel to What's the Big Deal About Bitcoin, but actually when the split happened, and there was a Bitcoin Cash split again, and at that time I thought, well, I actually don't think I can write the book I want to write anymore, because that's too complex. I don't want to be like, hey guys, Bitcoin Cash is actually what Bitcoin was supposed to be, and then have to say, oh, but we actually split again into Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin mm-hmm. SV and blah, blah, blah. So I just decided to kind of hold off on it. But this opportunity presented itself perfectly. So I essentially get to write a lot of the stuff I was going to write anyway, just for somebody else.
Right. So that being said, and yeah. that project laid out there, you have been less active with Patterson and Pursuit, your podcast, a little less active on YouTube. And yeah. I always look forward to seeing your appearances on social media. I noticed in the last several months that there is a little more salt in some of what Perhaps. You're posting. And I guess it goes back to that conversation that we were having a few years ago. And you look at the work that you've done, and you know the book you wrote about logic and trying to get those ideas and trying to get those methods and those abilities into the minds of more people. That's been a big part of your project with Square One and with the podcast. And of course, we know what I do, and I trace a lot of the problems that manifest politically, socially, economically, she's now medically, to have roots in the lower levels of school and in higher education and in that kind of professional training. So I think we can both look back at the last four or so months with lots of frustration, considering the skin that we've tried to put in the game. But, you know, as all this goes on, I said this to you in the Ideas into Action Summit too, that you were one of my like go-to people. Like, I want to know, what does Steve Patterson think about things? And that was one of the reasons why I included you as a presenter. And it's interesting, in the end of your presentation, you actually had one of the longest presentations in the whole summit. We were talking about navigating the medical industry from like a critical thinking perspective, and how to properly evaluate the thinking abilities and the openness to what is of like medical professionals that you might be trusting with your life, you know, or that we all might be trusting with our lives generally. So I thought that might come up again today, considering some of the subject matter. But yeah, let me just start in a really open-ended way and just say, as you look back at what has developed in this country over the last four, almost 5 months now, go ahead and vent. Let's start somewhat reckless, and then we'll focus it in on some value for the audience.
Well, I'll just tell you, I have decided it is in the interest of me and my family to start the process of leaving the States. Mm-hmm. We're planning on moving overseas in the spring of next year. As long as our health is there, then I'd say that's a greater than 50% chance. And it's on the table now to go the whole distance and renounce citizenship if it comes to that. But I'm extremely pessimistic on the United States. It's a weird mixture of the States being in some ways the best place in the world, yeah. because there's a spirit of entrepreneurialism here in a minority now of individuals, which is second to none. There's a spirit of freedom and appreciation for freedom in a minority of individuals that is second to none. But I think those people have lost power, or rather maybe others have gained power. And I see all signs trending really bad directions. You know, you might have the good parts of Silicon Valley, the entrepreneurialism, this semi-libertarianism, at least at one point from Silicon Valley. I think that's lost.
Sure.
So which is incredibly depressing, incredibly depressing. So I'm actually going to be leaving the country. I'm planning on leaving the country next year. Number one on the list for us to go to is Japan. They don't necessarily have the freest political system, but from what I've experienced, they have the best culture in the world.
Yeah.
I felt way culturally freer over there as a foreigner than I do in the States now. The other option, well, there's three options. One is, number one is Japan. Number two is to live long-term is New Zealand. Hmm. Even though they really don't have a lot of civil liberties, my wife and I are thinking of doing a bit of the homestead thing, like having some animals. We're trying to get the highest quality food possible and maybe raising your own livestock is the way to do it. And New Zealand's the best place to do that. And then the third place is St. Kitts, which might sound familiar because this is where Roger Ver, yes, Bitcoin entrepreneur, right? That's where he got his citizenship. They have an economic citizenship program where you can essentially purchase citizenship or invest in a certain amount of real estate there and you get citizenship. And so he renounced U.S. citizenship, went there and lives in Japan. And interestingly enough, lives in Japan half time, I think the other half of the time he spends in St. Kitts. So those are kind of the three options because, I'm just really pessimistic, man. I don't see how the American culture corrects itself. I don't see by what mechanism the train gets put back on the tracks. Maybe it will, but right now I don't see it.
Yeah. I mean, the optimism that we used to have versus the cynicism that's developed in the last couple of years, and that has certainly accelerated just with what we've seen so far in 2020. I know these things are hard to predict because they're very complex, you know, social and political systems, but what are you most concerned about as far as what's going to play out in the United States, like for the rest of 2020 or, you know, within this next few years?
If I had to say what the biggest is, it's something like, it appears to me that the American political system is failing. And I think this is what it looks like when an empire fails. And I think there are money grabs that are happening from the Treasury right now that look to me blatant. That is not a sign of political health. And so I think it's very plausible that one or two or three or four presidential elections from now, we get either a radical leftist or a radical right-wing guy. I think, and if I had to guess, I'm way more scared of the left right now than I am the right. Actually, as an interesting side note, I was doing some historical Nazi research the other day.
Yeah.
And a side note to the side note, this took me by surprise because I was trying to listen to Goebbels, one of the main Nazi party leaders, the propaganda guy, Hitler's propaganda guy, Joseph Goebbels. And I was just doing academic research as I do. I didn't think twice about like, oh, it's Nazi research. Oh, look out, a crazy right winger. But some of the videos, some of these documentaries and stuff I was looking for were taken down from YouTube. I couldn't even access as a researcher, wasn't even conceiving of this being some scary thing. They were taken down from YouTube. I couldn't access some of them. And so I had to find others because they were being taken. They were being censored. But that's just interesting.
Let's dig into that because obviously this has been a subject of fascination. I was a history teacher for a while. The Nazis have come up a time or two on School Sucks. Do you think it's like, I don't know how sinister and how much we want, like what kind of sinister motives we want to assign to this, but is it the erasure of like the cause and effect of this is how, is that what is most dangerous about it? Is like, look, this was a first world country, a very Western country. They were having a kind of cultural upheaval in many ways, a sort of cultural revolution in the Weimar Republic before Hitler rose to power. Maybe that's scary for that information to be out there.
That's a very hard question.
Yeah.
I honest to goodness, I don't know. And it's fascinating to explore different possible reasons that one might give for censoring the history, the valuable history of Nazi Germany. Here's at least what would be said, I believe. If we were to have the panel of academic experts tell YouTube why they should censor Nazi propaganda or Nazi history, not even propaganda, Nazi history. One of the videos I watched that was taken down that I saw elsewhere, it was essentially a cautionary documentary on Goebbels.
Yeah.
It was like, It was like sinister music and everything so clearly portrayed as a bad guy, and yet it was taken down off of YouTube. I think if we listen to them, it'd be something like, the masses are so stupid that if they hear these ideas, they will be persuaded by them. And the mere hearing of a Nazi speak is sufficient, a sufficient risk to create more Nazis that we have to censor them to prevent weak minds from hearing them speak.
Okay, so that I think that's a reasonable read of what it might be from responsible. I mean, that's very much in line with like the responsible left-wing academic, like what would you do without our, you know, intellectual, cultural, political leadership, you fools. I'm wondering if it's just so much of what we're seeing right now in terms of the kind of corporate virtue signaling, if it's like, you know, we really would love to have a, well, no, we don't even know what a scalpel is. All we have is a chainsaw. It's the only tool that exists. And that's what we're going to use. Just as far as like things that are being removed, like removing Gone with the Wind from some streaming service. It's more of just a slash and burn kind of approach to this thing hits for certain keywords and we take it down because, you know, it would animate or excite people on the alt-right or people who have racist tendencies. Kind of similar to what you're saying.
They're very plausible that that's the case. I mean, we could also go more sinister. I mean, I don't know how sinister and conspiratorial you want to get.
As much as we can.
I'll feed into that by completing the story.
Okay.
So I was doing this research. And there's a few interesting things I noticed from this Goebbels documentary that I took away from. One of them, I thought it was an interesting fact that apparently the Nazis were giving out free radios to German citizens because they viewed it as a brilliant propaganda tool.
Sure.
They thought, oh, look, we'll just, oh, radio is this amazing method of communication here. We'll just happen to give you a radio and tune in every night at 8 p.m. and you'll hear the truth from the Nazi Party.
It's the North Korean TV, right?
Yeah.
Or it's basic literacy in America, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was an interesting strategic decision, that they were so on it and aware of the power of controlling information channels that they were out there giving out radios to people. The other thing I took away from it was this, which was very unexpected. They had clips of Goebbels speaking to or giving speeches to this, you know, huge crowds packed full of people. And I was not expecting, because I hadn't done a bunch of Nazi research before, I wasn't expecting the transparentness of the aggressive rhetoric. Like they, you know, if you listen to left-wing people today, they'll say, people, the far right, they speak in code words. Mm-hmm. And they're always like a wink and a nod. They use these special language. They can't say things outright, but really they're trying to get together to wipe out minorities.
Right.
Well, maybe that's the case. I don't know. But then I listened to Nazi rhetoric and it's like, we're going to stuff the mouth of the Jews once and for all. And then it's like, you know, when the great leader calls upon you, you need to be ready to sacrifice yourself for the Nazi cause, for the great state. And everybody's there like chant, you know, you got these essentially churches filled with thousands of people all chanting in unison how they're ready to go to total war for the great leader. And I'm like, okay. If that were Nazi Germany, the rhetoric in Nazi Germany compared to the States?
Yeah. You mean at that time or compared to the States today?
I mean the rhetoric, how great a threat is the radical right in the United States? Some people might say, oh, it's a great threat and they're organizing and we're going to have concentration camps and they're ready to exterminate people. However, if you're looking historically, there is no rhetoric, no public rhetoric anywhere close to the kind of stuff that was taking place in Nazi Germany with these people like actively chanting that they're willing to sacrifice themselves to the state and fight in total war to implement their ideology. It's not even close, the extremeness of the rhetoric. And yet you compare that rhetoric, you compare the radical rights rhetoric in the past to the radical rights rhetoric today versus the radical left's rhetoric to the of the past to the left's rhetoric today, there's much greater similarity between the Marxists and the Maoists and how they're speaking, the actual words that they use and rally around in the 1940s or the 1960s, than what's going on with the American left today. So it was very fascinating to me when I'm trying to judge the relative risks of political instability in the States. I'm going, oh, okay, well, if history has anything to say here, I think we're way closer to tyranny from the left in the United States than we are tyranny from the right.
That the extremeness of their rhetoric is matching up better with what you saw.
Far better.
Okay,
far better.
So I think one of the reasons why, and that is a scary thing that it's happened, because they've been really, that is happening, because they have been really clever about it for a long time. I know you're probably at least familiar with Alinsky's Rules for Radicals book about how the subversion of, you know, like being a political operator and kind of a social operator through these tactics that he lays out in the book, there's subtlety to it. And a lot of that subtlety has disappeared. Now, I think the lack of subtlety in the 1930s and 1940s coming from the Nazis is there had been no Holocaust, right? There had been no war on the Eastern Front against Russia, where people are, you know, there had been World War One. They had experienced very hard times, but like the difference is, or one of the differences, there had been no World War II and there had been no Holocaust. And after those things existed, it's like you look at the American academic left, right? Before the Nazis, they were like, yeah, eugenics, sure, it's great. And after that happened, it's like, well, maybe we should like try to be the parents of these people more than kill them or sterilize them. So I think that there's a big shift to account for there in just like what should you say or what sets off alarms for people after these things have already happened versus before.
I think there's another dimension to this, which is when you're there's one type of analysis, which is listening to the leaders. How do the leaders communicate? Mm-hmm. There's another type of analysis, which is what can motivate a regular person or regular people to commit acts of atrocity or to get radicalized into something as crazy as Nazism. And I'm not sure that subtleness is the way that people get whipped up into a frenzy to go to war, to go to a total war for some great leader. So I might totally be wrong about this, but I'm thinking about it from the perspective of like, how do you get thousands of people in their little churches fired up, ready to enact violence on a massive scale? I'm not sure subtlety is the way to do it. Maybe it is. But to your point also, so I think the left has been way better organized than the right for a long period of time. And I listened to an interview with Thomas Sowell, and he used a good phrase that when he was asked about why all of this crazy left-wing progress is being made right now, and he said that they were in strategic positions a few decades ago, primarily in academia. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. They're just better strategy, better positions of power. But I, also, when I'm trying to judge the relative threat from the left and the right, I'm thinking, okay, the left is moving right now.
Yeah,
like the Marxists, and it's not even, I don't even think it's an exaggeration to call a lot of these people Marxists, because some of these people are explicit Marxists. Like you listen to the Black Lives Matter leaders, some of their stuff is about dismantling capitalism explicitly. They're like explicitly Marxist. So they're on the move right now and making a bunch of progress and doing the thing that the Maoists do.
Yeah.
they burn the books. They have the public shamings. I mean, I see all of that is happening in real time right now. I just, and so I guess to get back to the original idea of judging relative threat level, left is a big problem right now. And I'm also worried in the long run, what will happen when a lot of upstanding Americans are fed up with the left and the left's encroachments on their freedom. And I don't see a easy way for people who are more on the right to combat the radical leftist movements that are taking place right now. And that really scares me.
Now, if we had just like a moderate left-leaning person listening to this, they might say, what are these guys talking about? The president is a far-right guy. in a lot of ways, at least in rhetoric, right? Even though his governing doesn't seem to match that in most cases. But I was thinking that we were at that point in 2016, that when we saw the inauguration and we saw the appearance of Antifa, that all of that would escalate very quickly, and it didn't, right? So now we're seeing a resurgence of that. Where all the echo chamber walls have just grown so much higher, so much bad blood has continued to boil, and maybe this is the point. Because, I mean, that was my thinking. It's like there is every excuse to advance totalitarianism in this country from the right, from, you know, a Republican president. It would be a very, very easy thing, easiest time in our lives, I think, to justify that kind of expansion and that kind of
control. For the
right
or the left. I think Sanders, if he got inaugurated, it'd be the same type of threat, maybe even worse.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I don't think once it got to that point, once it had those tools to wield, it probably wouldn't look that different. Right. Just as far as, you know, who gets rounded up or who gets punished, who gets punished the most or silenced.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm, there might be some targeting there. But, you know, again, it just winds up being a chainsaw where you need a more precise tool. So, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, obviously, the left is way ahead culturally. And one of the things that we've talked about on my show is, you know, and I think Malice talked about this a lot in The New Right, too, their cultural head start through entertainment, through mainstream media, through Hollywood. I keep trying to warn people about these late night comedy shows and things like The Daily Show. That's a really powerful kind of finishing school for the most safe and acceptable messages from mainstream media, where it's like, come together. Since the news told us this and now we all know it's facts, let's get together and laugh about it so we can reinforce our ideas. And if we're laughing at people who don't think like we do, it obviously means we're smarter and we're better. And that didn't have a very positive impact. I mean, I don't think that's you can put most of the blame on it, but I think it did have an impact, and I think it wasn't positive on this last generation who came up thinking that was kind of like a sensible alternative to watching the news. So
I agree. And so yeah, in your expertise here, you've done more historical research than I have. How does this get corrected? Because the way I'm looking at it from a philosophical perspective, because this is my bias. I'm thinking the difference in philosophy between the right and the left is so great and so vast, and there is no way you can begin to resolve differences or tolerate each other without rationality, it's pre-rationality. Mm-hmm. It's being able to say, okay, I'm just going to listen and expose myself to ideas that I disagree with, and not think immediately that the people I disagree with are bad people.
Right.
That pre-rationality, the most basic function of thinking clearly, like just listen first, understand the ideas before you judge them and the people nonetheless. That's not here. It's not even close. And instead, that is not given. I see, honestly, if I'm just being frank, I do see the anti-intellectualism coming stronger from the left. They are so utterly convinced of their intellectual and moral superiority. I think they view it as an insult to their own self-image to entertain the possibility that somebody who was more conservative could have something reasonable to say.
Well, that's a feature of progressivism. It's like, we wish we had time. We wish we had time to deal with you, but we're too busy progressing. You know, I won't even justify that with a response. I can't even. It's just like this short circuit that any person would be so foolish to question this that's already been decided. And what are you talking about? This is anti-intellectual. It's in academia. It's in the media. It's in the New York Times. It's like,
yes. And we must talk about this too when it comes to COVID, because we're seeing the same. I think there's some depth to that psychological problem, in my opinion, to explain the COVID phenomenon. But so we see this. So we got two groups of people, two generally, if you can lump people together, it's two groups of people, two big political parties, big political mindsets and movements. And at least one of them is not even pre-rational. So how then does that problem get fixed? if especially if people who are of that mindset gain political power and start doing things like, let's say mandatory vaccination, they say, look, it's for the plebs good. Yeah. Like you people on the right are so stupid that now it's a matter of public health and we have to intervene and forcibly do some medical procedure for your own good. Now, what happens? That is actually happening in various states and various schools. New York City, that has happened with the Orthodox Jewish community. They're in a bunch of trouble now because they don't vaccinate. And oh my gosh, there's a measles outbreak. And oh, this is a public health issue. It's now the plebs can no longer run their own lives. So this is already taking place at small scale. When something like that happens nationally, how the hell does that get resolved, Brett, without violence?
Yeah, I don't think it does. I mean, I definitely would have felt more confident saying this like 5 or 7 years ago, that there is a large, somewhat rational, silent middle between these two extremes. But you only ever hear from the extremes. You know, I mean, my father and I, this was one of the first lessons he ever taught me about politics is like the people that you hear on television are the shitheads. You only hear from the shitheads. They're the ones who make the most noise. You don't hear from any, but there's a whole bunch of people in the middle. Some are Democrats, some are Republicans. They agree. They work together. You'll never see them. You'll never hear, but you'll never know who they are because they're not good for entertainment, right? And that was maybe – he might have told me that when I was – this might have been before there was 24-hour news. I learned that lesson. So if you think about how that's been exacerbated, I still – even though, yes, that's the function of media as entertainment or news and politics as entertainment, I still believe that there was a decent sized group in the middle who, while they might be conformist in a lot of ways, like, you know, like public school, I don't think it equips us to be critical thinkers. I think that's a non-controversial statement for this conversation and for this audience.
An understatement, yes.
Okay. And I think a lot of people kind of go out into the world like sailboats, right? And there's just no sailor, you know? And they'll go where the wind takes them. It's like, hey,
and
come
no
to school.
No boat and no wind. They actually just are drowning. They just drop from a plane straight into the ocean.
Well, no. I mean, if you want to make a positive argument for school, it's like before you go to school, you're just a boat. We give you a sail. And then you go out and the wind blows you. But all the wind culturally, or I think so much of the wind culturally, again, from the same forces of entertainment, mainstream media, higher education, is going to blow you to the left. Right. Mm. But just in sort of a casual way where it's like these are the agreed upon. This is an agreed upon, rational, responsible, scientific way of seeing the world. But most people aren't very motivated to do anything about it. They're just kind of conforming to being over that line on that side. We'll vote for the Democrat. We'll watch CNN. I think that has been a majority of people. And I have said that when we see people willing to burn things or willing to riot or join Antifa, that's an effective barometer of what a lot of young people are thinking, like the ideas that are penetrating into their heads. They're just not unwell enough to act on those things. So I don't think we ever have to worry about this reaching a critical mass where it's like most people engaging in this kind of behavior, just because most people don't, they're not unwell enough or they don't have the courage or they don't have the stamina for it. I mean, the George Floyd thing, people are already burned out on that. What did they make it? 3 weeks? Like the most diehard people made it 3 weeks. So I think the group of people who are extreme enough and dedicated enough and motivated enough is very, very small. But I don't see a resolution that doesn't involve finding a way, and I don't know this way, for all of those people who are more rational and more centered, not that I'm saying there's anything good about, you know, being centered politically or just being middle of the road, but if those people can't be amplified into the conversation and the middle is just removed, you know, like obviously we saw Stefan Molyneux lose his YouTube channel. Now, Stefan Molyneux would be hard-pressed to say that he's in the middle. Right. The middle, like I'm just a rational voice promoting peace. That might be true. Right. He's a rational voice. He has, by and large, over the last, 10, 15 years, promoted peaceful solutions to complex social and political problems. But the middle, I'm not sure. He kind of took a turn more to the right, you know, over the past few years. But if we want to give him the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, you're in the middle because you're promoting nonviolence. He said in his talk, he said, they're getting rid of people like me because we're in the middle. They don't want people to think there's a middle, you know? They only want the extremes to exist. So I think that that's the thing. If there is any hope, and I'm not sure that there is, and I spend most of my time observing what's going on right now, those observations make me think things are going to get violent and there isn't going to be any other kind of resolution. So it's like, you know, a real difficult path forward. But it would mean putting more voices of mediation into the mix than there are. And I have no idea. Like I said, I have no idea how that happens. I mean, that's something that I like to think we're doing, but because of the perception management that goes on, would people who watch CNN or read Vox listen to you and I talk and think this is a conversation of moderation? We're dangerous, problematic people for even questioning this dogma.
I think it is not the case that the majority of people need to be part of a ideological fringe. Well, I guess it wouldn't be a fringe if it's the majority. Ideological extreme camp in order to see tyranny.
Yeah.
Like I think it is this small, organized, dedicated, loud people. Those are the movers of history, unfortunately. There are rational voices. A good example is Joe Rogan, right? Like he's got his flaws, but he has the biggest podcasting platform in the world, and he's laughing and criticizing the current extreme cultural leftism, and yet all of this crap is still taking place. I definitely think the pendulum will swing, and there will be a correction. I don't think it's going to be in the next 10 or 20 years. I think you're going to have a generational shift, because the people I went to school with, most of them, 98% of them, were fools. And they were propagandized by their dumb professors. They lapped up a bunch of leftist ideology, and they are not going to question it. It is an essential part of their self-identity to be a morally and intellectually superior person than Republicans, conservatives, or people that disagree with them. Mm-hmm. They will not conceive of the possibility that, in fact, they are not as morally enlightened or intellectually enlightened as they believe themselves to be. I think the stakes are this. For on the individual level, it takes nothing less than a version of psychological suicide to recognize that your ideology was wrong, especially an ideology which a key part of it is your own superiority, your own moral superiority. If the thing that you're holding your hat on is, well, at least I'm a better person than other people, and you turn out to be the shithead because of that, that is essentially some kind of psychological suicide. Some people can do it. God bless them. They are special people. But the vast majority of people don't have the strength, the ability to actually come to those types of conclusions. They will walk off a cliff, follow people off a cliff, push people off a cliff in order to maintain the coherence of their little psychological self-evaluation.
Yeah, I forget who said it. It might have been Mark Twain. Something like, too bad it's so much easier to fool people than to show people how they've been fooled.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've definitely noticed in my time of political awareness is that having a personal profile that is very much your identity online and using it as a place to post about politics intertwines your identity with your beliefs, right?
Good way of putting it.
And when your beliefs are attacked, especially when so many people haven't done the really important self-exploration and self-work, when people struggle with low self-esteem, because of unresolved issues from childhood or from their schooling or in their adulthood, wherever they occurred. When people are carrying a lot of trauma or I know baggage is a very loaded term, but you know, for our purposes here, I think it works. When they're carrying that stuff around with them, this is a kind of respite in having the identity of moral and intellectual superiority. That does seem to be, even though it is spread in this right identitarian movement, I think it has been much more a feature of the left, right? Because it's all about I'm a good person and I'm a virtuous person because I do these things or I think these things. So if these things are questioned for their goodness, or my gosh, you're told they're actually evil, they're actually just going to lead to piles of skeletons, I would have a meltdown if I was really holding on to that. And I had my identity wrapped up in that to the extent that some people do. So I think that social media is a factor there, but I also think that that is a kind of conditioning that the sort of Manichaeism that people learn through media or through higher education, that there is the light and there is the dark and we are the light and you are you belong to the light and
yes,
you can
and you
draw
always
all this
have
value.
Since childbirth.
Yes,
despite never having thought of ideas from another's perspective, you were just born pure.
How lucky, you know, that you found the one right and true way to be. By the time you were 21 years old, and all you had to do was sit there and listen to somebody explain it to you.
Exactly. And it's so fortunate that they also were around other people listening to the same intellectual leaders who happened to be morally and intellectually pure. Amazing. Mm. And I want to say two things. One, there's another dimension to this I wouldn't have even conceived of a decade ago, but is becoming more and more plausible to me now, especially after Julia and my health journey, is that I think there's actually a physical health component to this. Mm. If our theory, well, it's really Julia's theory, but I'm going to call it our theory, is accurate or roughly accurate, then the physical health of Americans is very poor. We have very bad diets. And from a nutrition standpoint, we might not be getting a couple of really key things that everybody throughout history was eating and then we stopped eating. At least in part because of the brilliant ideas of academics in the 20th century, naturally.
Right.
If that's true, there's also, it would not surprise me at all if physical degeneration plays a role in cultural and intellectual degeneration. And I'm going to say one other pessimistic thing here. So it's easy to criticize the evilness, let's say, for lack of a better term, of the left right now, because those are the people that have power. However, when the pendulum shifts, and it will, the right is going to have a very scary and dangerous version of the exact same thing.
Totally agree.
And it's very disturbing. And you think about it, put yourself in the mindset of a 16-year-old, rational 16-year-old who does not have strong enough social ties to be part of one group or another. And you're observing and you're listening to the left and to the right. It would not be a difficult conclusion to say that contemporary leftists that you hear in academia and the media are insane. In fact, it wouldn't even be a stretch if you were a young, rebellious, angry teenager to say these must be inferior people themselves. And that's a very, very scary thought. And that is what is going to come, in my opinion, because there's going to be a huge rebellion against abject insanity and incompetence. That is our instead of having any competence hierarchies, we have incompetence hierarchies. And there's going to be enough young people that recognize that. And they say, look, we're done. We're not going to pretend like these ideas, this whole set of ideas, the basic assumptions of the religion of the left is some type of equality. Mm-hmm. And they're going to say, no, we reject the whole thing, whole cloth. And now we're going to set up a political, a cultural, some type of social structure in which we're very far away from that. And that's going to have some ugly, ugly properties. I think this is also why the stereotype of far right extremism is things like racism. Mm-hmm. And I think not the watered down racism, like real like the claims of inherent biological superiority that result in different political structures based on your biological composition. Yeah. That's kind of the antithesis of the contemporary left, the left wing idea. Maybe not the progressives in the 20s, but well, we'll forget about that. But I think if young people are going to reject the insanity which is the left, I think a whole bunch of them are going to go way over to the right, And that's also, I think, depressing and disturbing, and in my opinion, partially inevitable.
Don't you feel like that's already happening?
I think yes. The beginnings have already been set of that, for sure.
Right. So, long story short, you're leaving the country.
There you go. Pretty much.
Helicopter, helicopter, let your long rope down. Let us sway into the sunset. I have done all I can do. Helicopter, helicopter, let your long rope down. Let us sway into the sunset. I have done all I can do in